from the Sky News Centre at 6. The first Premier League club ever to go into administration hopes to be given permission to sell players outside of the transfer window. The administrator dealing with the Portsmouth situation says they'll have to offload one or two stars. Supporter John Westwood changed his name by deed poll to Mr. Portsmouth.
We want to know where the money's gone. This is what we beggars believe. I mean, we've sold Diarra for 20 million, we've sold Defoe for 15 million, we've sold Johnson for 17 million, we've sold Crouch for 11 million, and yet we're still in this mess. How can that be? It just doesn't add up.
The Chancellor's welcomed new figures that confirm Britain is out of recession, but it warns there's a lot of uncertainty around. Revised figures show growth of 0.3% at the end of 2009, up on the 0.1% previously thought. Three British service personnel have now been killed in Afghanistan in as many days. The latest was a soldier killed by an explosion in Helmand during Operation Moshtarak. His family's been told. A luxury cruise liner has crashed in Egypt, killing three crew members and injuring three British tourists. The ship slammed into the pier as it docked in Sharm el-Sheikh in strong winds. Raunchy music videos and lads' mags are being blamed for damaging children. A Home Office commissioned report has found that young people are being exposed to more and more hypersexualised images. Penny Nichols from the Children's Society says many children feel under pressure to look attractive and thin.
What children told us was that a significant number were really unhappy about their appearance. Much of this has been driven by the way in which a particular stereotypical body form is pushed at children and young people through all sorts of media.
And a city's ring road is to be named after a computer game character who was created there. Derby City Council's calling its inner ring road Lara Croft Way following a public vote. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Hardiman.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice. Your choice. Digital TV switchover is coming to the West Region in March. Everybody in Bristol needs to be ready. Do you know someone who might need help in switching to digital TV? If they are 75 or over, registered blind or partially sighted, or eligible for disability benefits, the Switchover Help Scheme offers them practical help to convert one of their TV sets to digital. To get the help, they need to respond to the letter the Help Scheme has sent them. If you know someone who is eligible, give them a helping hand and remind them to apply for the help they are entitled to. You could even help them fill out their application form or ask them to call free on 0800 4087 656. The Switchover Help Scheme is run by the BBC under agreement with the government. For further information, visit the website helpscheme.co.uk.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Could tell, just like an old time movie about a ghost from a wishing well. In a castle dark or a fortress strong, with chains upon my feet, you know that ghost is me. And I will never be set free as long as I could read your mind, love. What a tale your thoughts could tell. Just like a paperback novel, the kind the drugstores sell. When you reach the part where the heartaches come, the hero would be me. Heroes often fail. Because the ending's just too hard to take. I'd walk away like a movie star who gets burned in a three-way script. Enter number two, a movie queen to play the scene of bringing.
this way, and I've got to say that I just don't get it. I don't know where we went wrong, but the feeling's gone, and I just can't get it back. If you could read my mind, love, what a tale my thoughts could tell. Just like an old-time movie about a ghost from a wishing well. In a castle dark or a fortress strong, with chains upon my feet, the story always ends. If you read between the lines, you'll know that I'm just trying to understand the feelings that you lack. I never thought I could feel this way, and I've got to say that I just don't get it. I don't know where we went wrong, but the feeling's gone, and I just can't get it back.
Gordon Lightfoot, and If You Could Read My Mind. A little bit later in this hour, we're going to be listening to an audacious new version of a Bee Gees hit, which questions the official story of the 9/11 attacks, and take a close look at what was happening to US President George W. Bush on that fateful day, September the 11th, back in 2001. But before all that, Marina Morris is here, and we've just had an inauguration ceremony over in the Ukraine. And so let's see exactly what was going on last weekend. Marina.
Yes. Yesterday, 25th of February 2010, was the inauguration of the fourth Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych. More than 1,000 foreign delegation, including 11 leaders of the state, arrived and took part in the ceremony. 4,000 policemen provided the security. Many of Kiev's roads were blocked, which upset the local population. Neither Prime Minister and President of Russia, Medvedev and Putin, attended. Ambassador of the Russia in Ukraine said they have a very busy schedule. For the inauguration of former President Yushchenko in 2004, Parliament voted for 1 million hryvnia, it's $1 million, for Yanukovych, zero. There were many empty seats in the Parliament during the ceremony because Tymoshenko and her supporters boycotted the ceremony. Former the second president Kuchma, who appointed Yanukovych as a prime minister in 2004, arrived, but Yushchenko didn't come to for this ceremony. The largest foreign delegation was from the European Union, including Foreign Minister Catherine Ashton. For the first time ever during these ceremonies, the president was blessed by the head of the Russia Orthodox Church in the Kiev-Pechersky Lavra Monastery, not just the head of the Ukrainian Church. And now a question for you, Tony. Which engagement did Yanukovych cancel after inauguration? A visit to Moscow to meet Medvedev and Putin, a visit to Brussels for a European Union meeting, a visit to Donetsk to see a football match between Shakhtar Donetsk and Fulham.
Oh, that's a difficult call. I'm not sure. I think it's either I don't think he went to the European Union. Let's say he went to a football match.
Okay.
We will see. Martin, do you want to guess as well on this one?
Presumably, he ought not to have gone to the football match if they were clashing with the other two, but I don't know.
Did he go to Moscow? Did he go to football? No,
he cancelled one of them. Is that right, Marina? He cancelled one.
One second. We will see later in the end of our conversation. Okay, if you ask me, Tony, what is was in inauguration speech, I will tell you. Ukraine has started a new historical period. It was inauguration speech of the Yanukovych. The country is facing a deep crisis, this economy deeply affected by the recession. The main problems was its returning international loans, poverty and corruption. The first task of Yanukovych will be to resume the effective system of effective state government and create a new professional team as his cabinet. His foreign policy will be a new type of multi-vectoral policy, placing equal emphasis on a strategic alliance with Russia, European Union and America.
But surely he's really going to be giving preference to the Russians rather than America and Europe.
He tried to have a good balance between Europe, Russia and American.
Okay, so anyway, in recent interview with the US news agency, what did he say?
In a recent interview with the American press, he explained his aim to make Ukraine a bridge between Russia and Europe, and also to make a bridge between the East and West part of Ukraine, unify the country. But what does he mean by a bridge? There are so many cultural differences between Russia and Europe, and even inside the country. Different lifestyle. For example, life expectancy 15 years shorter on average in Russia than in West. It's really very, very, very big differences. And the task looks like mission impossible. Can he actually deliver real positive change? Can he act as a catalyst to positive change? This situation, Ukraine situation, needs a fresh approach, this tact and diplomacy. Ukraine as a country has a big underdeveloped potential, and its educated population, vast mineral wealth, fertile soil. Can he do it? One side, he is known as a self-made man who never gives up. He was born into poverty, works hard, educated himself to becoming a doctor of economics, and he became governor of the Donetsk region and ultimately prime minister in 2002. But another side, does he have the fresh ideas? Can he see the new ways which will generate the change to improve the quality of life within the country? Public relations and spin will not change the country's fortune. And now, time for the right answer.
Okay, can we just get it clear? The question is, did he cancel one of these meetings, or did he actually go to one of these meetings?
No. Question was exactly, which engagement did Yanukovych cancel after inauguration?
Right, I would say possibly the visit to Moscow. Martin, what did you say?
Well, it ought to be the football match, surely.
But it's
not. And presumably it isn't. So.
Martin is right, really. Yanukovych cancelled the visit to Donetsk and to see a beautiful game between Donetsk and
Shakhtar. So he is serious then.
I only thought he wanted a bit of light relief after the all this politics and managing to win the election, that he wanted to sort of let his hair down a bit and cheer at a football match.
But Yanukovych has been heavily associated with this oligarch Rinat Akhmetov, who owns and financed the football club Shakhtar Donetsk in the region where he was governor. And due to the pressure on his diary, he missed the match. Result was 1-1 on the night and 2-3 on aggregate, which means the Donetsk are out of the competition. Yes. And what is important events? The first visit on the 1st of March, Yanukovych as a president will to the European Union. The second visit to be followed by a trip to Moscow, it will be 5th of March. Ukrainians hope that Yanukovych's presidency and his new cabinet will be more successful than his football club. And finally, about inauguration. Yanukovych's deputy head of his party said he will never be able to work in tandem with Tymoshenko, its prime minister, and would seek to replace her by the spring. Yanukovych has a list of potential prime minister, and it's not clear yet who will choose.
Okay, Marina, thanks ever so much. Now, Martin and Marina, if I can ask you both this, why is it, do you think, that Tymoshenko, although she lost by a very narrow margin, is boycotting and seems to be not very sportsmanlike about losing the election? Martin, do you want to start?
Well, I mean, obviously one can't read her mind from this distance. I think it's a shame because she's not got a legal case. It doesn't look as if she's got a legal case. And Yanukovych has been recognised now by the European Union, by most of the Western powers. She'd be wiser to participate in the parliament and be a good opposition leader, because she must be in a good chance of winning a future election. It's a shame that she's seen fit to boycott, but that's what happens sometimes in politics. It happened in Venezuela. Chavez's opposition refused to sit in the parliament, so he then got total power within the parliament, and that was their own fault, because they could have sat there and opposed him, but they chose not to.
Marina, have you got any insight into maybe why there's been this boycott? Why is it? I mean, surely if you're in a competition for a presidency and you lose, you should just, well, say, OK, I lost.
It's her choice, but absolutely understandable. He can get the task what he would like.
OK. All right, thanks very much. Now we're going to move on to have a listen to the UKIP president, who is actually, no, he's not the president of UKIP, but he's in the European Parliament. And many of the radio stations and TV have been playing a clip from Nigel Farage talking to the president of the European Union, Van Rompuy. But here's about, it's about a minute long. And this excerpt includes bits which weren't played on some of the other radio stations. So here we are. Here is Nigel Farage, and we're going to have a little discussion with Martin afterwards about whether he thinks that this is a wise way to do politics.
You have the charisma of a damp rag and the appearance of a low-grade bank clerk. And the question that I want to ask, that we're all going to ask, is who are you? I'd never heard of you. Nobody in Europe had ever heard of you. I would like to ask you, President, who voted for you? And what mechanism? Oh, I know democracy's not popular with you lot. And what mechanism do the peoples of Europe have to remove you? Is this European democracy? Well, I sense, though, that you're competent and capable and dangerous, and I have no doubt that it's your intention to be the quiet assassin of European democracy and of the European nation states. You appear to have a loathing for the very concept of the existence of nation states. Perhaps that's because you come from Belgium, which of course is pretty much a non-country. But since you took over, we've seen Greece reduced to nothing more than a protectorate. Sir, you have no legitimacy in this job at all, and I can say with confidence that I can speak on behalf of the majority of the British people in saying we don't know you, we don't want you, and the sooner you're put out to grass, the better.
The sooner you put out to grass, the better. Is this the way to do politics? This is last week in the European Parliament in Brussels. So what do you think, Martin, about this
style?
Well,
let's put it this way. That's not the way to win friends and influence people. And he says, we don't know you. Well, he could have had somebody he did know. He could have had Tony Blair. Do we want Tony Blair? We don't, in fact, want Tony Blair to be president of Europe. So having Van Rompuy, if that's his name, as a kind of figurehead president is just about where the European Union is at. The guy has not got any heavyweight power, and that's the whole point. He's basically a primus inter pares. He's a figurehead figure. He's like King Log. You want a king who's a log because he doesn't do anything very much.
But how can the European Commission have any real clout when it's made up of people who've just simply been appointed to the position rather than elected?
Well, that's a democratic deficit in the whole European project, isn't it? We've got one monetary policy set from Frankfurt, but we've got no compensating political structure. Now, that's because I don't think people are ready to have European-wide elections which will decide things. There isn't sufficient European identity, which is why we've gone far too fast on monetary union and not fast enough on democratic union, on building a democratic politics across the European Union.
But we do have Europe-wide elections for the Euro MPs, don't we? So why not?
We do, but most people would prefer the real decisions to be taken by their national parliaments. That's clearly the preference of most people.
But couldn't they select the Commission from amongst the MEPs, you know, the people we elect?
The problem with that is, if once you start creating a democratic structure at the centre, it will inevitably override national parliaments, and this has got to be properly thrashed out. We've actually had union by the back door so far, lowest common denominator union, and basically having a central bank, as Brian Gould was pointing out in The Guardian today, a central bank which has got no democratic control over it whatsoever, which determines policy for the whole of the union. that seems to work in good times, but in bad times, when difficult decisions have to be taken, you just get gridlock because people won't accept an undemocratic structure deciding vital things for them. So we've got a democratic deficit and an intellectual deficit in that free markets in themselves do not create democracy.
So do you think that the way the UK Independence Party is dealing with this, that is to just simply really poo-poo the leader of Europe in front of everybody?
Frankly, the only person Nigel Farage is seriously damaging by that kind of outburst is himself. It reminds me very much of Reverend Ian Paisley when the Pope came to speak to the European Parliament. He had to be dragged out kicking and screaming, accusing Pope John Paul of being the Antichrist.
But he's got a point, hasn't he? Because nobody actually knows who this Van Rompuy character is.
Well, as I pointed out earlier, if we had somebody we did know, like Sarkozy or Blair, we'd even have more cause for complaint because they would actually have some power. Now,
Recycle old politicians who've, sort of lost their credibility in politics.
We do for the time being because that Von Rumpy will not be able to overrule Angela Merkel. He won't be able to overrule Sarkozy. He won't be able to overrule Brown. He's basically a figurehead. And like the Irish president is a bit of a figurehead. Now, if we want a president to be a president, we could have somebody like Obama or Bush, but we don't want that. So in that case, we've got to have a figurehead, and he's the man that it is. And the fact that nobody's heard of him, that might be a good thing, mightn't it, if he's only a figurehead?
Well, I mean, even if the president and the various figureheads in Europe were taken from amongst the MEPs, we may not know who they were necessarily, but at least there'd be a bit more democracy, wouldn't there?
A bit more. But we need to actually, we've now got serious questions about Greece's relationship with the Union, the whole question of whether their monetary policy ought to be decided by the Germans, etc., etc. There's a really serious democratic deficit at the heart of the European Union. What I believe we need is a European-wide movement for a reflation of the economy. And that can't be done on an individual country basis. Countries are going to have to work together.
The European Central Bank surely could be behind that.
European Central Bank, as an independent central bank, has been captured by the money markets. It's not under democratic political control, and that's got to be the key. We must put the European Central Bank under democratic control and put politics back in charge, but that requires a European-wide movement for a democratic European Union, not just saying Belgium's not a serious country, which just suggests that Nigel Farage is not a serious person.
Okay, another, you mentioned The Guardian just then, but another article in The Guardian this week was actually yesterday's Guardian by Seamus Milne. The tide of anti-Muslim hatred is a threat to us all. This is Seamus Milne, who's the comments editor, also the son of Alasdair Milne, who used to be one of the producers on The Tonight programme many years ago and actually ended up as Director General of the BBC back in the 1980s, who was sacked by Margaret Thatcher for doing some essentially anti-Conservative Party programmes who were pointing out, there was a Panorama programme, for example, about the extremists, right-wing extremists in the Tory Party. Anyhow, a year later, after this demonstration against Gaza, it turns out it's the sentences that are truly exceptional. Of 109 people who were arrested in these demonstrations against the Gaza war in London, 78 have been charged, all but two of them young Muslims between the ages of 16 and 19, according to Manchester University's Joanna Gilmore. Even though such figures in no way represent the mix of those who took part, in the past few weeks, 15 have been convicted, mostly of dark violent disorder, and jailed for between 8 months and 2.5 years, having switched to guilty pleas to avoid heavier terms. This must be this plea bargaining thing, I imagine. Another nine are up to be sentenced tomorrow. That's today, actually, because this is yesterday's article. The severity of the charges and sentencing goes far beyond the official response to any other recent anti-war demonstrations, or even the violent Stop the City protests a decade ago. So, do the arrests, many of them carried out months after the event, in dawn raids by dozens of police officers who smashed down doors and handcuffed family members as if they were terrorist suspects, none of the 30-plus complaints about police violence have been upheld, even where video evidence was available. Now, this does sound as if the Metropolitan Police, and possibly anti-terrorist branch, although this is actually a reasonably peaceful demonstration, even though there was a bit of attacking of property as well. What's going on here, Martin? Why are the Muslims being given such long sentences and being selected for arrest, whereas it seems that white people aren't?
Well, the judge in the case, I understand, said that he intended to send a message of deterrence, presumably to young Muslim males between 16 and 19 about disorder on the streets. I think the disorder was regrettable because, in actual fact, there was a very big demonstration there against the brutality of what the Israeli Defence Forces were doing in Gaza, an absolutely legitimate cause for protest. And it's a shame that some minority, not just Muslims, saw fit to act in a violent fashion. But I think the sentences clearly are disproportionate, and it's bound to create a sense of grievance within the Muslim community. And I think that the judge who's handing down these sentences ought to have been a bit more sensitive to that possibility, and he ought to read his history about what happened in the north of Ireland in 1969 when the state started chucking its weight about.
Do you think
if you push people too far, then they will respond?
Do you think this is a similar thing here, where a particular group is being singled out as the Republicans and nationalists were Ireland?
Clearly, it was not just Muslims who were involved in disorder on the day, but it's only Muslims who are ending up in prison for up to 8 years. That clearly is very, very worrying. If the judge wanted to send a clear message, he should have sent down some of the white demonstrators for similar periods. Now, if that's not going to happen, then perhaps nobody should be sent down. People should be just told to calm down and to demonstrate in a reasonable fashion. And where people have acted violently and hurt people, then obviously some punishment would be due. But for those who've just perhaps, lost their temper in a moment of madness, that they should be treated leniently. I think we've got to be very careful about this. I mean, the young Muslims are rightly worried that they are being targeted by a racist police force. And we mustn't build barriers between the police force in this country and young Muslims. Young Muslims should be able to trust the police, and they should come forward to the police if they know anything about terrorist acts. If we're going to catch who the terrorists really are, then we need that kind of cooperation. And that requires give and take on both sides.
Later in this hour, we're going to have a listen to an audacious new version of a Bee Gees hit, which questions the official story of the 9/11 attacks, and take a look at what was happening to US President George W. Bush on the fateful day of 9/11 in 2001. But first, the Times has leaked today that the BBC are preparing to close a BBC Six Music, possibly, and also potentially up to half of its vast website. Is the Director General Mark Thompson caving in to pressure from Rupert Murdoch's News International and similar massive international media conglomerates? Last year's Royal Television Society lecture was given by Rupert Murdoch's son James up in Edinburgh, and he painted a picture of a BBC that had an unfair advantage over his family's commercial media empire, which includes Sky TV, HarperCollins Publishing, The Times and Sunday Times, The Sun and The News of the World, to name just a few. Rupert Murdoch sees the BBC being funded by the licence fee as unfair competition, but journalist and author of Flat Earth News, Nick Davis, doesn't agree. He sees Rupert Murdoch as a predator with a political agenda who is doing all he can to take out the media competition. Here he is, Nick Davis, that is, speaking on the subject at the Arnold Feeney last November.
Hi, my name's Rosie Wild. My question is, do you think there's a correlation between the concentration of the ownership of the news media and this decline in truth-seeking? Because it seems to me that the fact that Rupert Murdoch owns so much, not just of Britain's, but of the world's media, actually makes him more powerful than the government, and therefore the government has to kind of toady to him. And if each major newspaper was owned by a different person, then the government or whoever would be able to, say, go away to one newspaper because there would be a genuine alternative.
Yes, it probably is. I mean, Murdoch's... Yeah, I think you're right, this concentration of power point. And Murdoch's power is reaching the point where he's behaving like a cartoon caricature of a media owner. He just gets what he wants. And now he has his son, the repulsive James Murdoch, running around doing the same thing. James Murdoch made this speech at the Edinburgh Television Festival, where he argues that because the BBC has this very busy news website, which gives news away for free, the BBC is damaging newspapers, and therefore the BBC News website must be closed down, the licensee must be top-sliced, and all the rest of it. Just stand back and look at the history of newspapers in this country over the last 30, 40 years, and ask yourself, which family on this planet have done the most damage to our newspapers? How dare the family that launched The Sun and dragged our tabloid newspapers down into the gutter. The newspaper that bought the Sunday Times at a point when it was probably the best newspaper in the world and riddled it with inaccuracy and right-wing politics. How dare that family claim that anybody else has damaged newspapers in this country, let alone the BBC, which happens to have a culture of honesty. It's sickening, sickening. But along comes David Cameron, like Rupert Murdoch's catamite. You know what a catamite is, a kind of sexual plaything. And he says, oh, yes, Governor, you want the BBC cut back? Certainly, Governor. You want Ofcom's power reduced? Certainly, Governor. Anything else I can do for you? And actually, there is something else brewing on the horizon here. You should watch this develop. Murdoch wants to put a paywall around his news websites. OK, he has two big obstacles to do that. First of all, when he announced that, a lot of people said Murdoch is stupid, he doesn't understand the internet. You can attach almost every derogatory adjective in the dictionary to Rupert Murdoch, but not stupid. Right? Greedy, power-hungry, unscrupulous, that's Rupert, but you can't call him stupid. If he's to put these paywalls around his news website, he has to overcome two major obstacles. One, there's no point in him charging for the news on his site if other news websites are giving it away for free. So, number one, he sits down with the other news organisations and says, look, guys, I'll start charging, you start charging, we'll all be charging, and the BBC, get out, right? That's the attack on the BBC. That's what that's about, trying to get that free website closed. So, right, all the news websites in Murdoch's imagination reach a point where they all start charging. Then the other problem is, it only takes one geek to come over his paywall, grab his news, get over the other side, and mirror it out at 8 o'clock in the morning across thousands and thousands of other websites across the planet, and still nobody will pay to read Rupert's wretched news, right? So what is he going to do about that? Months, I've been trying to get people to listen to this for months. If you look at what's happening on the continent, the French, for example, have been trying to introduce legislation that says that if you download audio or video from the web to which you are not entitled, you will be cut off from the internet. You won't be allowed to use it. Once that principle is established, what is to stop governments, under pressure from these very powerful media proprietors, saying, and the same applies to text, if the geek comes over the wall and takes Rupert's news without paying for it, the geek gets cut off and is not allowed to use the internet. And have you seen that Peter Mandelson, who goes on holiday in Corfu with the Murdochs, has now introduced legislation along the French lines dealing with audio and video, right? You download those without consent, you get cut off. And he slipped in a paragraph that says this could have wider applications in the future in relation to copyright. That's Rupert's clause, right? It is happening. What you're looking at here is the entire world wants the internet to be unregulated. This tiny, very powerful elite of media proprietors want the internet to be regulated so that they can make money out of it. And so a battle will emerge. The people of the planet against its media proprietors. Who's going to win? I wouldn't bet on the people. Huh? Governments do what these creatures ask for.
So who would you bet on? That's Nick Davis there speaking at the Isle of Finney back in last November. He's the author of a book called Flat Earth News, what someone you might call a journalist's journalist. And he's one of the people who's been working on this story to do with Andy Coulson, been in The Guardian on the front page the last couple of days. So Martin, who's going to win this battle? If Rupert Murdoch does want the internet regulated and the people of the world and many other newspaper people as well want it to be open, who's going to win the battle?
I think they've got a real problem of trying to get people to pay for the internet, no matter what their fantasies may be. But they clearly want to try and control the internet. What's interesting is the politics of that, as was pointed out by the contributor, that Peter Mandelson has actually done the bidding of the Murdoch. But I understand that in the House of Lords, the Liberals and the Conservative peers have ganged up on Mandelson and thrown it back in his face. So that's rather interesting, isn't it? We've got a new Labour politician pushing Murdoch's interests and Liberal and Conservative peers who are trying to block him.
So we're also hearing today that possibly BBC Six Music is going to go. Is this a channel you've ever listened to? Have you got one of these digital radios?
No, I haven't. I listen to BBC Radio 3 a lot, so I use BBC Television a great deal.
Well, Six Music is actually very good. I mean, I've listened to it from time to time. I don't have a digital radio, but I listen to it on the internet sometimes. There's lots of new music. That is to say, it's doing a little bit what people like John Peel used to do, you know,
which is all to the good. And Radio 3 does similar work with Late Junction. I mean, there is a real problem here for commercially oriented media organisations. The BBC has a remit to provide good quality stuff for free. And of course it's going to be hard to compete against that when you've got rubbish to sell for money. If you're providing good stuff for free, who's going to spend good money on rubbish? And it does create problems for the commercial broadcasters. But then that's their problem, not ours.
And it's
one of, you know, perhaps commercial broadcasters, if they can't make money at commercial broadcasting, will have to go into something else. Murdoch will have to just sell up and go and start a business doing something else, and we can't compete.
One of the problems seems to me is the BBC is very much tied into all this digital switchover, and so what they seem to have been doing with BBC 4 on the TV and with BBC 6 Music is putting all their best stuff, all the best material on digital, in with their fingers crossed behind their backs, hoping that people will then go out and buy digital radios.
Yes, I mean, but at the end of the day, the BBC only has to break even and cover its costs, doesn't it? So, I mean, yeah, I mean, obviously, as I just pointed out, commercial broadcasters do not want competition from something like the BBC. They'd rather it wasn't there. But I think from the point of view of democracy, from the point of view of what people want, it should be there. And if commercial broadcasters can't compete with it, as I say, well, perhaps if they can't make money doing what they're doing, they'll have to go and do something else. That's called the market, if you like. Although we're rigging the market against them. And there's nothing wrong with rigging the market against them. I mean, do we want to have free access to news and opinion? Or do we want to be told a lot of lies by plutocrats? It's a question of what we want, isn't it?
Well, Rupert Murdoch's News International Empire is one of about five massive commercial media companies that are beginning to dominate everything we see, hear and read. So powerful are they that many believe they can make or break governments and political parties. The one thing stopping this is what's called cross-media ownership rules. But so influential is the power of media barons like Rupert Murdoch in government circles that these are being eroded right across the Western world. Their main aim is what's called regulatory capture. Many of the rules stopping companies gaining monopolies or near monopolies in local media or national media by owning TV, radio and newspapers and book publishers and magazine publishers have been successfully abolished by big media. One such occasion was in the United States about 8 years ago. But one of the commissioners, that was on the Federal Communications Commissioner, Commissioner Copps, spoke objecting to the decision to allow cross-media ownership, much more of it. And he explains why now.
Commissioner Copps.
Good morning. I strongly dissent to this decision because today the Federal Communications Commission empowers America's new media elite with unacceptable levels of influence over the ideas and information upon which our society and our democracy depend. At issue is whether a few corporations will be ceded enhanced gatekeeper control over the civil dialogue of our country, more content control over our music, entertainment, and information, and veto power over what the majority of our families watch, read, and hear. Radio deregulation gives us powerful and relevant lessons. When Congress and the Commission remove radio concentration protections, we experience massive and largely unforeseen consequences. Diversity of programs suffered. Homogenized music and standardized programming crowded out local and regional talent. Creative local artists found it ever more difficult to obtain playtime. Editorial opinion polarized. Competition in many towns became non-existent, as a few companies brought up virtually every station in the market. This experience ought to terrify us as we consider visiting upon television and newspapers what we have inflicted upon radio.
Concerns about the degradation of broadcast content do not justify government manipulation of consumer choice. Degradation is just an elitist way of saying programming that one does not like.
The decision allows the giant media companies to buy up the remaining local newspaper and exert massive influence over a community by wielding three TV stations, eight radio stations, the cable operator, plus the already monopolistic newspaper. The decision further allows the already massive television networks to buy up even more local TV stations so that they could control up to an unbelievable 80 or 90% of the national television audience. Where are the blessings of localism, diversity, and competition? I see centralization, not localism. I see uniformity, not diversity. I see monopoly and oligopoly, not competition.
It would be anathema to the First Amendment to regulate media ownership in an effort to steer consumers towards other programming.
90% of the top cable channels are owned by the same giants that own the TV networks and the cable systems. More channels are great, but when they're all owned by the same people, cable doesn't advance localism, editorial diversity, and competition. And those who believe the internet alone will save us from this fate should realize that the dominating internet news sources are controlled by the same media giants who control radio, TV, newspapers, and cable.
I refuse to pour 1 ounce of cement to support a structure that dictates to the American people what they should watch, listen to, or think.
The public reaction against the proposed changes has been unlike anything the FCC has ever seen. Of the nearly 750,000 comments we have received, nearly all oppose increased media consolidation, over 99.9%.
Those commissioners voting in favor of the item signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed signify. The item is adopted. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.
And you can see it, hear a little protest going on in the background there at that Federal Communications Commission meeting about the consolidation of media. That is getting rid of the cross-media ownership rules that mean that one company can only own one or two communication or media outlets. Anyway, Martin, what are your thoughts about what's happened in the US and how things are going here? Because at least I know that one of the things that the Labour Party has done over the last month or so is actually force News International to sell some of their shares, saying that no, you can't have cross-media ownership to the way you want it. It's not just an open market, you have to stick to the rules.
Well, I mean, since Rupert Murdoch decided that The Sun and his other newspapers are not going to support the Labour Party at the next election, they're probably getting their own back. It's tit-for-tat time, isn't it?
But who's in charge here? You know, is that actually these big media companies, or is it the government? Who's got more clout?
Lance Price, who used to be a member of Tony Blair's team in the Number 10, said there was always an extra member of the cabinet whenever we were discussing any issue, and that was, what would Rupert think? And that's, so he wasn't powerful, actually in, that's how powerful these people
he
are.
He wasn't actually in the room, but they were saying, you know, what's Rupert going to say about this?
That's right.
Well, this is a bit worrying, isn't it? Anyway, that was Commissioner Copps speaking just now, who's a US Federal Communications Commissioner at the little demonstration at the US Federal Communications Commission meeting about the effects of relaxing the rules of media ownership. The security service, MI5, is supposed to stop foreign interests spying within the UK. MI6 operates abroad, gaining information for the use of the British military and government, but they both take a great interest in what the media are up to. In the 1980s, a book by Guardian security correspondent Richard Norton Taylor called Blacklist showed that MI5 were vetting all BBC employees. In a chapter called The Christmas Tree Files, he showed that MI5 had been through all BBC personnel records and stamped a Christmas tree on the file of every screenwriter, journalist, producer or editor who had left-wing leanings. Why a Christmas tree? Well, that's the tune to the German song Tannenbaum, which is the left has adopted as the tune to its own song, The Red Flag. The collusion between the national media in the US and the CIA is well documented, particularly by the late great US documentary maker Alan Frankovich.
The CIA, they have a kind of false openness. You see, a lot of what they do, for instance, in overseas posts, is they talk to the press, they manipulate the press. I would say that if you took a percentage of their operations, you would find that a great percentage-wise really have to deal with getting out their line through the media. Because if they accomplish that, in a sense, they control the way you see a situation. They control the way you think about a situation. So they have an ability, really, and they feel very much at ease with press and media. And they have, God knows, the number of books which have been written by former CIA people to take a pro-CIA position. And it's only recently that there are some people like John Stockwell, Philip Agee, and a couple of other people who have really decided, well, if the pro-CIA people are writing books, why don't we write books? But we'll really go into the nature of some of these operations.
So a lot of these people who are CIA operatives that you interviewed thought they were using you and manipulating you to get their point of view across. Wasn't there a point that they found out that this guy Frankovich may be doing a hatchet job on us? And at that time, did you get any less cooperation from the CIA or worse?
I don't think they really paid much attention to what I was doing. You see, because it was, I think at the moment when they realized that this film was on a scale detail that they had not even imagined. Because, you see, you're dealing with 5 years of your life. You're dealing with a research effort where I researched for film, background film, in just about every film library in the world. I did a range of interviews of 50 to 60 to 80 people. Now, on the other hand, you have to realize that, for instance, one of the persons interviewed in the film is a former president of CBS News, the founding president of CBS News and Public Affairs, and he says that when he became president of CBS News, they had a relationship with the CIA. He had inherited this relationship, and it involved providing cover to CIA representatives, but it also involved, and this is incredible, providing any material they had in their news library to the CIA. For instance, the CIA wanted to identify somebody in a country who was leading a demonstration. So you're dealing with a level of collusion, and you're dealing with the fact that there is a level of contact at the top level of the networks, and they're reaching 50 million people a night. So what the CIA is concerned about, they're not concerned about a little book or a little newspaper article in The Nation. They're concerned about things which really tell you the truth about what they're doing. And in this case, in the CIA on company business, it's entirely told you by people in the agency, and then reaching a large number of people. Because the very reason they keep their operations secret is because if they try to explain them to us, they would find very little to justify them.
That was the late, great Alan Frankovich there, talking in the late, early 1980s, actually, about collusion at the highest levels between so-called free press and the US intelligence agency, the CIA. So, if the CIA have been colluding with US intelligence and the media, could they make the 9/11 attacks in some way to look as if they were carried out by somebody else? Certainly the BBC and other media have reported many of the supposed hijackers from September the 11th attacks are still alive. Anyway, a group from Brighton called the Freebies have produced a song which also questions the official account of 9/11, along the lines of an old Bee Gees favourite. This is also produced by the same people that made the song we used a couple of weeks ago called 9/11's a Lie. Anyway, this is the Freebies with their version of 9/11's a Lie.
This is from the old school, new school. We are
Three B's there, and that's free as in F-R-E-E, not three, three B's, and 9/11's a lie. Now we ask, what was happening to George W. Bush on September the 11th, 2001? Did you know many people believe he was threatened using the code words Angel is next whilst in midair in the presidential jet Air Force One? But who was doing the threatening? To answer the question, we hear the opinion of author of George H.W. Bush, an unauthorised biography, Webster Tarpley. By the way, Tarpley was prohibited from speaking in 2007 at Bristol University by head of communications, Barry Taylor, and the vice principal, who said there was a risk that he would bring the university into disrepute. For many, it was a Stalinist-style control freakery by the publicly funded university bosses that actually may have brought the university into disrepute by their actions. Anyway, here is Webster Tarpley talking about George W. Bush himself being threatened during the actual day of September the 11th, 2001.
Not enough attention has been paid to the political evidence, and the political evidence is two things. One is the ultimatum to Bush from the secret government, from the rogue network. In other words, the people who carry out 9/11 send Bush a threat. Angel is next, Angel being the code word for Air Force One. And it means, Bush, you are a target. With the idea then being, if you don't do what we want, we can do without you. We can liquidate you even in the course of the day. And what they want is the war of civilizations. They want him to announce terrorism. They want him to start talking about bin Laden, Al-Qaeda. They want him to invade Afghanistan. And when this threat comes in at 9 to 10 o'clock in the morning, I have a whole chapter in my book about it. I'm indeed the only person who writes about it. The thing is in the New York Times, confirmed by Condoleezza Rice. There's no doubt that it happened, and it's real. Debka, which is, of course, close to the Mossad in many ways, they confirmed it. Namakon, a group of KGB old boys who have an internet site in Russian, they confirmed it. And Réseau Voltaire, using, I believe, Russian and maybe some French sources, also confirmed that this happened. So Thierry Maison, the first guy who really wrote about 9/11, is also on this line. So the idea, therefore, is that Bush is not a part of this planning. He's not a mastermind. He's not somebody who's, you know, told in advance what's going to happen. He's put in front of a fait accompli. One of the points of this thing is to get him to be active in a way that he would not do otherwise, since his general personality state is catatonic.
And slowly over the day, his line changes.
Right. Yeah, because he said, first he says terrorism. In the school in Florida, he says terrorism. And then when he gets to Barksdale, Louisiana, he says he does not mention terrorism again. And then when he finally makes a speech in Washington in the evening, he makes clear that he has capitulated to the rogue network in the course of the day by saying, we will make no distinction between terrorists and those who harbor them. And by that time, with Richard Clark screaming, bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda the entire day, it's clear that that means he's going to invade Afghanistan. So he has, in effect, capitulated to the rogue network, or, you know, rushed to become their eager puppet. And that's something that, you know, Tony Blair reportedly prodded him to do it. Tony Blair came in on the side of starting the war of civilization. So that's the angel is next. It was denied later by the White House, but it did happen. And then what? Then we have the drills, right? That's the other thing. 25-plus drills. A lot of them are taking place on the morning of September 11th. Some of them have just been wrapped up in May, June, July, August. Some of them are in advanced stages of planning. So these represent capabilities. 25-plus drills, you don't have to take my word for it. Paul Thompson, even though Paul Thompson really believes in the official version, has done yeoman service. If you look at the 9/11 complete timeline of Paul Thompson at Cooperative Research on the Internet, he's got a whole long article, which is nothing but the drills of 9/11.
Now, probably the most important of those is the nuclear war fighting drill.
That would be the Global Guardian drill, right? That the skies are filled with nuclear bombers, the missiles and submarine-launched missiles are ready to go. Ivashov in Moscow says before any airliner was hijacked, he could see a huge display of thermonuclear power being put into the skies, right, from the satellites and radar that he had. And that is obviously designed to intimidate Russia and to prepare for the fact that in the course of the day, one of the things the Rogue Network wants is to give an ultimatum to Russia that the U.S. is going to seize Afghanistan, which is a country that in the past Russia had considered essential to her security, and they'd fought, God knows, a bloody war for 10 years to keep the place neutral. And it had remained neutral, more or less, but now the U.S. is going to seize it. A certain kind of Red Army traditionalist might have said, no, that's casus belli. But in the, of course, Putin, much more flexible, highly intelligent. I thank the lucky stars for Putin on that day and since. He is the most intelligent and flexible head of state in the world that we have. And he chose a policy of war avoidance, which was to say to the neocons, you want Afghanistan? Wonderful, take it. You'll see what you find.
You'll okay.
find weakness and defeat, and Russia will get stronger and the U.S. will get weaker. And that's exactly what.
And that's exactly what's happened. Well, U.S. historian and terrorologist Webster Tarpley there, who was prohibited from speaking at Bristol University, talking about the manipulation of George W. Bush on the actual day of September the 11th, 2001. Well, Martin, can you tell us a little bit about Mr. Tarpley?
Well, as you know, Tony, he came over to Britain a couple of years ago, and we were helping him to go around and talk to various people. What I would suggest to people who are listening to this as they're driving home or at home is, if you want to follow up any of the things that Tarpley's talking about, just do a search on your computer and you'll find most of his material. He's a very, very well-informed gentleman. I'd just like to pick up on one point that he made. General Ivashov is another very well-informed gentleman. I've mentioned him various times on this programme. General Leonid Ivashov was chief of staff of the Russian Armed Forces on September the 11th, 2001. And if people do a computer search for General Ivashov, they will find him saying that as far as he is concerned, 9/11 was an inside job. Now, I think that's news that ought to be on Radio 4, it ought to be on BBC One. The head of the Russian armed forces on the day of 9/11 believes that it was an inside job. Even if it's not true, it's a very important fact, because no doubt the Russian armed forces are making their dispositions and plans on the basis that they think that it was indeed an inside job.
Well, Tarpley's quoting Russian sources also there, saying that as far as the Russians could see, using all their radar and intelligence gathering and aircraft and that kind of thing, that even before the attacks happened that morning, it looked like there was some kind of big nuclear defence exercise going on.
Lots and lots of exercises going on the day. I think people should, if they want to know more about this, they should check out Webster Tarpley's website, where a lot of this material is. But Tarpley is a personal friend of General Ivashov. Yeah, so it's not just...
Is it possible he's being manipulated by the Russians?
It may be that the Russians have their own reasons for pointing the finger at the Americans and the Israelis for 9/11. But nevertheless, when we were talking at the very beginning of the programme 2 hours ago, we talked about war. If the Russians believe that the Americans and the Israelis carried out 9/11, even if it isn't true, that means that we are sitting on a hair trigger of a volcano, and that's where we are. I mean, whether they did or they didn't, that's what the Russian armed forces believe to be the case.
Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2, where from our Barton Hill transmitter we review the week's news and discuss some of the big stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world. If you want a story discussed, have questions about this evening's programme or would like to suggest a topic or a guest for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Conservative Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim in the first hour, Chair of Bristol City Council Audit Committee and Temporary Leader of the Conservative Group on Bristol City Council, Jeff Gollop. Thanks also to our resident Old Labour pundit and Oxford economist Martin Summers and to Marina Morris for this week's report and council tax Vox Pop. Next week at 5 on Friday Drive Time, Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows, will be here to help us review the news. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all previous Friday Drive Times, including my special report on mobile masts and wireless safety, and we're hoping to have a debate on that in the next few weeks. And find out what's coming up next week by going to bcfm.org.uk and clicking on presenters or podcasts to find my page. A podcast of this show is usually available by the midnight after broadcast. Up next, it's Somali language programming with Nemo and Somali youth, thankfully back after absence last week. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
listening to BCFM 93.2.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.